Next news as it happens. Next scheduled report at 4:30 with Lester Smith. It's 4:15 in the afternoon. Enter Bob and Ray.
And a happy Tuesday to everybody. Tuned in for the next 3 hours, we hope, to one of the best programs we've done this year.
Modestly speaking.
Well, I can say that with authority. I've seen the material.
You know, weather like this, though, gets us thinking. We'll be doing our show up on the roof again from the WOR Roof Garden Studio.
Well, either there or from the plaza downstairs. Which do you think is better?
Oh, I like to do it from the Roof Garden Studio high atop New York City.
Yeah, I guess that is
just a short drive from Midtown.
Better view.
For your dancing pleasure.
We have a word about a couple of late trains on the Long Island. We'll get that out of the way, and then we'll get to the word wizard. 3:30 from Flatbush Avenue to Long Beach is 13 minutes behind schedule. Now expected to arrive at 4:32.
Uh-huh.
And the 3:37 from Huntington to Port Walt Jefferson is 23 minutes late. That's now due at 4:53.
Right in, Stapley.
Here he is, the word wizard, Dr. Elmer Stapley, one of the nation's leading authorities on the meaning and derivation of English words. He's here to answer questions you listeners send in about our language and its correct use. And are you all ready to take a fling at the first question, Doctor?
Well, Mr. Elliott, your malpractice of the word fling leaves me completely spontaneous.
Oh?
According to Webster's Inebriated Dictionary, a fling is a type of dance most often amalgamated with Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
The best knowledge of these is the Highland fling. Therefore, enduring back to your question, we might speak of dancing a fling, but never taking a fling. Do I make myself unstable?
I think you made it that way.
Good.
Let's move to our first question here from a lady in Canada. She writes, "For several years, I've kept a pet reindeer in my yard. Now I want to get another one, but I'm not sure how to refer to them when I have two. What is the plural of the word reindeer?"
To give a plurality to any word, you merely add an S onto the end. So obviously, in this case, it would be reindeers.
Well, I don't believe you're right on that one, Doctor. When we talk about Santa Claus, we refer to his whole team as reindeer with no S on the end.
Well, how many of them does he have?
I think he has 8, if I remember correctly.
Well, that's the difference right there. This woman only plans to have 2 of them, so it's reindeers.
I see. You sure you just want to leave it that way, huh?
Well, no, in the interest of complete accuracy, I might add that you're wrong in saying we refer to Santa's team as reindeer. We refer to them as Dancer, Prancer, Donder, Blitzen, and 4 other guys.
Okay. Well, let's move along to another question here. From a man in Louisiana.
Sure.
Says, "I have a collection of Elvis Presley records, and I've often wondered about the one that's called You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog. Isn't there something grammatically wrong with that title?"
Yes. A hound is a specificated breed of dog. So making a referendum to a hound dog is really saying the same thing twice. And one of the two words should be subliminated.
You don't see anything else wrong with the title, Doctor. How about the phrase You Ain't Nothing?
Well, the main thing wrong there is that it makes a terrible song title. Would you want to listen to a song that was just called You Ain't Nothing?
No, I guess not. I think the reference to the hound dog helps it, really. So let's move to a final letter. This is from another woman. She's in Oregon.
Oh.
She writes, "When my doorbell rings, I never know whether it's one person or more than one out there. So am I more apt to be correct shouting, who is there or who are there?"
Well, of course, you can never be sure about that. But I think the best bet is to shout, who are there? After all, we've got 3 billion people in the world now, and it's not likely that they're going to be ringing this woman's doorbell one at a time, so I recommend the plural.
Yeah, that seems reasonable. Even if there's only one person out there at the start, you have a good chance there'll be more will show up later, especially if you wait long enough to answer the door.
Well, that's right, and of course, you don't have to keep shouting when the later ones ring the bell if you've used the plural in the first place. That covers all of them, and
mm-hmm.
they can just yell back when they get there.
Well, it's really quite easy to choose the correct grammatical form if you just stop to think of all those things first, isn't it?
Yes, but it's amazing how many people don't stop to think at all before they write dumb questions to me. You know?
Well, maybe just as well in your case, Doctor. If people stopped to think before they wrote you, they'd probably decide not to write. But I want to thank you anyway for stopping by to share your knowledge of the language with us.
Well, not at all. I was lubricated to come.
You seemed like you were pretty well oiled when you walked in, but that probably won't prevent us from inviting you back again. I hope all of our listeners will join us for another informative session with Elmer Stapley, the Word Wizard. Chester Frisbee is with me for a moment here before he goes into the other studio to direct the backstages, and you've created quite a lot of interest with your rack and pinion discussion there.
Well, I've had a lot of reaction. I'm grateful to several people who've answered or written in
right.
explaining rack and pinion steering.
We had a letter from a little girl, I think, who has a Frisbee named Chester Hasbrook.
Is that so? I have a feeling you made that up.
No, it's true right there. Maybe you want to send her an answer.
That's fine.
But it seems like a lot of people are hung up on rack and pinion.
When you see rack and pinion, the rack is a rod with gear teeth cut onto it. It looks sort of like a sharp edge of a saw. I'm quoting now from Bretton Unger, who's editor of Small World.
Right.
It connects the two front wheels, and the pinion is a circular gear on the bottom of the steering column. When the steering wheel and steering column turn, the pinion teeth engaged in the rack teeth cause the rack to move and the front wheels of the car to turn.
Good. Well, now that it's that clear.
Most American cars utilize a type of steering known as recirculating ball. Although more complex and less responsive than rack and pinion, the recirculating ball system is better suited to the variable ratio power steering required on most American cars. You see?
Yeah, you're going to have all this information.
Well, I'm as stuck now as I was before.
Mr. Mitchell, we've finished your muffler job, but before we look over to Bill, I sort of want to explain. You see, when we got under your car, we ran into
some problem.
Jimmy, tell Mr. Mitchell how bad that muffler was.
Very bad.
It's not going to run more than you said.
And the tailpipe, huh?
Very bad.
But the price you gave me over the phone.
Oh, that was before we got a look at that connector pipe, right, Jimmy?
Very bad.
And the bill.
Very, very bad.
Anybody will be glad to give you a price quote. But at Midas, we give you the price quote that sticks. It's our Midas free written estimate. Before we ever lift a wrench in your car, we show you on paper exactly what parts you'll need and exactly what it will cost. And the finished job will never cost you one penny more. At Midas, we haven't just been building business for 20 years. We've been building trust. Come to Midas. We're specialists. We have to do a better job.
There are over 50 local Midas shops in the New York metropolitan area, including northern New Jersey, Long Island, Westchester, Rockland, Orange, and southern Connecticut. Consult your Yellow Pages for the shop nearest you.
And it's the...
Next, Mary Backstage, Noble Wife. The story of America's favorite family of the footlights and of their fight for security and happiness against the concrete heart of Broadway. Harry and Greg have had no luck in their attempt to find the American consulate in Milan to seek help in finding Mary. And we see them now as they return to their suite at the Hotel Raphael, and we hear...
Well, guess we're on the fool's errand.
Hi, Greg, Harry.
Oh, hi.
Wow.
How long you folks been back here?
About half an hour.
About 40 minutes, I guess. Well, we gave up. We got into one of those pool rooms by mistake.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And look, I made a neat little bundle of money.
Hey.
Played rotation with some guy there, and I cleaned up.
Quite a stack of lira there.
Well, congratulations.
We gave up, too.
But this is their paper money.
Yes, right.
I think lira is the paper money.
Oh,
I didn't understand.
Yes, it is.
Oh, I see.
No sign of the consulate from your direction, huh? No, we couldn't find it.
I sat there on the bench and tried to think what we should do, and I'm lost.
Yes, we both are, and Mary certainly is.
Well, that's right.
I don't know what we're laughing about.
No, I don't either.
La Traviata opens when?
Opens this coming Friday.
This Friday?
That's right. That's only 3 days away, and we haven't even had one rehearsal yet.
Suddenly, I'm beginning to be concerned again. Do you have any wine here?
Yeah, I've got some over here, Mr. Barlow.
Oh, good, good. That always helps me when I'm concerned.
I'm concerned, too, but...
I'm not too concerned, but I'll join you anyway.
Well, I certainly hope we'll hear from Mary at least today or tomorrow, so that we can have at least one rehearsal before Friday night's opening.
Say when, Mr. Barlow.
That should do it. Thank you.
How about you, Harry?
Yeah, sure. I just can't think of any way to go about finding Mary. It seems to me she would have phoned us by now.
Look, she'll show up. I know she will. She's a very dependable person.
Is that enough, Harry?
Yes, I guess it is.
Sure, she's a very dependable person.
She knows we're opening, at least, and she's never missed an opening yet, to my knowledge.
No, sir. And I've been producing a lot of...
Wait a minute. There's the phone. Maybe that'll be some news.
Well, I hope so.
Hello?
Hello?
Mary!
Yeah, Yes, Harry.
Harry, yes. Where are you? We've been looking all over Milan for you.
You'd never believe what happened to me.
Well, tell us.
Well, no, I can't tell you over the telephone. They may be listening.
They may be listening?
Yes.
Who do you mean?
Well, I can't say over the telephone.
Well, where are you, Mary?
I'm not sure exactly. I'm here in Milano. Do you have the music for the opera? Because I want to come back there and rehearse.
Well, Greg has the libretto and the music and everything right here, yes.
Good. Well, then I'll take your care. What's the hotel? I had forgotten.
The Raphael.
Raphael Hotel.
The corner of Genise and Galano.
All right. Well, I've been down here at the Favuzzi Beauty Parlor having my hair done in the bouffant style.
Well, you'd better get over here as quickly as you can, Mary. My, this is good news. And so Harry hears from Mary at long last, and she prepares to return to the Hotel Raphael. Tomorrow rehearsals begin, and you ought to be here when we'll hear Greg Barlow say,
"Wow, Madame Favuzzi did some job on your hair."
That's tomorrow in the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage Noble Wife, Word Carr speaking. Mushies, the great new cereal that gets soggy even without milk or cream, brings you another exciting story of adventure starring Tippy, the Wonder Dog. As we look in on the isolated cabin of Grandpa Witherspoon today, we find that a forest fire is raging through the valley. Gramps is lying on his cot, waging a desperate struggle to avoid inhaling the smoke. Meantime, little Jasper stands by the front window, watching the flames move over the crest of a nearby hill. Suddenly, he turns and speaks.
The fire's getting closer, Gramps.
Consarn it all, I know the fire's getting closer. I'll have no way to water down the cabin and save it unless that fool dog of yours gets back soon. I sent him to the store for a length of garden hose.
Well, don't you worry, Gramps. Tippy will be here with that hose in plenty of time. He's the brightest, smartest dog in the whole wide world.
Well, consarn it all, what's keeping him? I sent him out when we got the first warning of a fire hazard. That was last July.
Oh, it'll be okay, Gramps. You didn't specify how many feet of hose you needed, so Tippy and the hardware man are probably trying to, you know, make an estimate. But I'm sure it won't take much longer. Tippy's the finest, the smartest dog in the whole wide world.
Well, consarn it all, here I am getting weaker from breathing that smoke. You're just a slow-witted boy who can't help. And the lives of both of us are in the hands of a fool dog.
Hark! I think I see him coming up the road now, Gramps. Here, Tippy, Tippy, Tippy.
Well, consarn it all, give me the hose so I can start watering down the place.
Sorry, Gramps, but that wasn't Tippy I saw. It was just the Foley's wolfhound headed home with a box of asbestos shingles.
Every other dog in the neighborhood can be sent out on a simple errand when there's an emergency, but that fool mutt of yours just gets himself lost.
Well, Tippy's not lost, Gramps. We heard on the radio how the fires closed the main road, so Tippy probably had to run home by way of the county seat. But he'll make it. He's the grandest Wait. I see him coming now. Here, Tippy, Tippy, Tippy.
All right, consarn it all. Where's my garden hose?
That wasn't Tippy after all, Gramps. It was that scrawny dog with the mange that hangs around the Weber place.
Yeah.
He was headed down toward the Red Cross station, dragging one of the Weber kids along.
That mutt's got so many diseases he's half dead, but he's out doing chores you could never trust to that fool Tippy.
Oh, don't talk that way, Gramps. Tippy's the finest, the smart... Wait. I see him for sure now, yes, sir. Racing up the path at breakneck speed to save us in the nick of time again. Come on in, Tippy. That's a good boy.
Good boy. Get that hose hooked up and start watering the cabin fast.
Well, I guess Tippy wasn't able to bring it, Gramps. See, he's got his mouth filled with that old tennis ball I used to throw for him to fetch.
Consarn it all. If we come out of this alive, I'm going to teach that dog a thing.
Wait, don't you understand, Gramps? Now, Tippy's trying to give us a message. Bringing in that tennis ball means he's getting his valuables together and preparing to evacuate. So I guess we'd better follow his example and do the same thing, because Tiffy's the brightest, smartest dog in the whole wide world.
Today's incredible action story has been brought to you by Mushies, the great new cereal that gets soggy even without milk or cream. Join us again soon for another thrilling adventure of Tippy the Wonder Dog.
Say I'm selfish. How can you say I'm selfish when you know it isn't true? I don't want a lobster, a crab, or a shellfish, darling. All I want is you. Take a tree in the meadow, and I'll do the same. It's a tree in the meadow, irregardless of the name. So don't say I'm selfish. How can you say I'm selfish when you know it isn't true? Country, the scenes that we've seen. Never once did I ask you to chip in for gasoline. So don't say I'm selfish. How can you say I'm selfish when I'm selfish for you?
Lou Carter. And DeMassey Cadillac, Route 9W in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, invite you to take a Cadillac Seville home today free. And drive it, you'll love it. This unusual offer is made by DeMassey Cadillac so you can see for yourself what this magnificent new international size Seville is all about.
And now, Rorschach, the gripping story of a big city cop who wages an endless struggle to find crime wherever he looks for it. As our scene opens today, Lieutenant Rorschach is in the interrogation room grilling a suspicious character.
I'm warning you, Punk. The longer you stick to that cockamamie story, the harder it's going to go on you. Now, I'm going to ask you just one more time, and you'd better sing out loud and clear. Are you sure you got the right address on that bicycle theft report that just came in, Captain?
I keep telling you, Rorschach, I'm positive. In fact, the only thing I'm not sure of is whether it's all right for you to yell at a superior officer this way.
Never mind that now. We've got big trouble. Now, this address is a vacant lot. And you know what it means when people start calling in phony crime reports. They're trying to divert our units out of an area where they plan to pull off something real big. But it's not going to work. Steinberg, Lopez, Caruso, get in here on the double. Okay, man, now here's the picture. We got a bicycle theft reported at 3541 North End Avenue. Only that address just happens to be a vacant lot.
Well, excuse me, Roy.
Shut up, Jack. Captain. I'm not through. Now, Steinberg, I want you to pull in units from all over the city to cover this area that's unprotected. Lopez, see to it that no more squad cars are dispatched. The calls we're getting are all phony. And Caruso, you run a complete list of bicycles and vacant lots through R&I. And if you see a pattern forming, I want to know about it. Okay, now move, all of you.
All right,
now, Captain, what's your problem? You got something else you want to bellyache about?
Well, not exactly, Rorschach. It's just that you told them the phony address you got was 3541 North End. But the way I gave it to you was 3451, so it probably wasn't phony at all.
Oh, well, I guess I'd better Change the way I copied it down in my report book, then.
Hey.
Wait a minute. My pencil eraser's gone. I always keep it in this top desk drawer. And it was there when I made my 6 o'clock office supply check. Steinberg, Lopez, Caruso, move it in here.
You, Lieutenant. Yeah, what's up? Yeah, it's right there, Lieutenant.
Okay, man, the crime wave spread until it's right here inside headquarters. Steinberg, I want you to make an office-to-office search. Now, if you find a room with more than one pencil eraser in it, get back to me fast. Lopez, put out an APB. We're after an oblong eraser, maybe 2 inches and a quarter long, reddish-brown, black smudges on both ends. Caruso, you take the airports, bus stations, and rail terminals. If anybody tries to leave this city, kill them. All right? Move. I tell you, Captain, I got to have a dose of my ulcer medicine. These big crime waves are getting to me.
Well, don't you think maybe you're pushing yourself too hard, Rorschach? Stealing a dime store eraser is not really a big crime wave.
Not a crime wave? To you, grand larceny right inside police headquarters is not a crime wave? Listen, I've been on this force 27 years, and I know what's coming. Today, some maniac takes an eraser just for kicks. But then he goes after the bigger stuff, fancy cars, jewelry, priceless art treasures. I spent a lot of years cleaning up this city, and I'm going to keep it clean. Do you read me?
Yeah, sure. Incidentally, when you were waving your arms around and blowing all the papers off your desk, I noticed there was a pencil eraser underneath them somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I've been looking for that. Thanks a lot.
And so without fear, without hesitation, and without getting his facts straight, Rorschach wages endless war to stop crimes that may never happen. Join us again soon for more exciting police drama in the career of Rorschach.
Now more Bob and Ray in Radio New York over WOR New York.
And now through the auspices of the Bob and Ray Public Affairs Department, we wish to present another thought-provoking editorial on one of the critical issues facing all of us today.
We're required to state here at the very beginning that the opinions expressed are solely those of Bob and myself and do not necessarily reflect the views of this station or its advertisers or members of their families. However, I might add that if any of those people disagree with this editorial, then they're dumber than we thought they were.
Yes, it's hard to imagine how any thinking person could take issue with our opinion that ships going up and down the Hudson River should be required to stay as far to the right as possible.
Now, we realize that there already is a certain amount of caution over safety that's displayed by most ship captains on the Hudson. But I'm sure you've all seen the occasional show-off who comes racing down the middle of the river as if he owned it, and seldom, if ever, is he flagged down and given a good talking to.
Now, this is particularly true when the show-off is a foreign ship captain who wouldn't understand what you were talking about, even if you did give him a good talking to.
Now, that would be like the Norwegian captain of a Norwegian herring boat, just for example.
Right. However, we hasten to add that this is just an example. As Ray said, we have no proof that any specific Norwegian captains are guilty of the kind of conduct we're deploring.
Correct. We want to make it very clear that we consider the Norwegians to be fine, hard-working people who would never run their boats up and down the middle of the Hudson River at breakneck speed, probably. However, we have seen some ships weaving around out there with funny flags on them, and the Norwegian flag could conceivably be the one with three green stripes running slanty-wise and a curved sword in the middle.
Actually, we don't know which nation it is that has a flag like that, so to our good friends, the Norwegians, we can only say, if the shoe fits, wear it.
My thinking exactly. However, our concern is in keeping these hot dog ship captains out of the middle of the river goes far beyond our feelings about any particular country. It's obvious that considerable breakage could result if two ships headed in opposite directions were both jazzing down the middle of the river at the same time.
Cost of repairing dented freighters, like everything else, has gone up in recent years. Even a quick side swipe can go well over the $100 deductible insurance carried by most shipping companies on their boats. That's why we're urging that captains stay as far over to the right as they possibly can.
Now, that's important. It not only will prevent the occasional sideswipe collision, but also will give captains coming downriver a larger area in which to make left turns into docks on the New York side.
Now, this, of course, cuts down on another potential cause of accidents. Many ship captains forget how fast they're going when they're coming south of the Hudson with the current behind them. Then, when they try to make a sharp left turn in front of oncoming traffic, they lose control of their boats and plow into a dock or a warehouse or even West 34th Street.
Now, we know that many of you are thinking that when we urge that ship traffic on the Hudson be required to stay as far to the right as possible, you're thinking that many vessels will get too far to the right and run aground. We don't disagree with that. But we ask you frankly, isn't this a small price to pay for accident prevention?
Of course it is. Now and then a grounded ship may sink and become a total loss, but most of the time, a quick call to the tugboat service will send help rushing to the scene to get the stranded vessel on its way again quickly.
True. Now, we've investigated the situation and found that it seldom takes more than a few weeks to refloat a grounded ship. Of course, a cargo of perishable items might spoil in even that short time, but we ask you frankly, isn't this a small price to pay?
You know it is. However, if there should be any responsible party who disagrees with the views expressed in this editorial, we're obliged to grant equal time for a rebuttal. Details and scheduling information may be obtained from our Bob and Ray Public Affairs Department. However, we sincerely hope that none of you will show your ignorance by taking the opposite side on this matter. Thank you.
No, especially for not showing your ignorance. Thank you very much.
The People Bank, for people like you. Ridgewood Savings Bank believes in you. People like you, like us, it's true. The Ridgewood Savings Bank, for people like you.
There are free gifts for you at the new Whitestone Flushing office of Ridgewood Savings Bank. Free souvenirs for everyone, plus free valuable gifts for new deposits of as little as $100. We're at 2529 Parsons Boulevard in the Linden View Shopping Center. Special late hours and weekly drawings for fantastic door prizes. So come on over for your free gift at the new Whitestone Flushing office of Ridgewood Savings Bank.
People like you, like us, it's true. The Ridgewood Savings Bank, for people like you.
Member FDIC.
And welcome again to Burn Boyle's Vanishing World of Vanishing Animals. Today, venturing into the upper reaches of the Himalayas to search for the shaggy-coated musk oxen.
The climate and the people of far-off Tibet both seem hostile and repulsive to those of us who view the world through Western eyes. And yet, we have one vital thing in common with the Tibetans. We both dislike the shaggy-coated musk oxen. As a result, this proud beast has virtually disappeared from its native habitat. And that was why our group challenged the windswept Himalayas to capture one specimen while a few still remained. Slowly, our pack mules made their way up the treacherous narrow trails, past the 18,000-foot level we went, then 19,000, then 20. Still, we sighted nothing that could be considered unusual. Then, on our 23rd day out of the base camp, my faithful Sherpa guide, Ling Yong, uttered the words I had been waiting to hear.
Choi Da Poing, boss man. Choi Da Poing.
What he was saying was true. Indeed, an avalanche had swept down the mountain the night before and wiped out the trail behind us. Already, we were faced with the grim reality of not having a trail in front of us. And so, leaving two-thirds of our 11 pack mules behind, we headed out on foot across the trackless snow. And then, utterly exhausted, we continued on. And at last, my faithful Sherpa guide, Lin Yong, approached me with great excitement.
Shaggy-coated muskox, boss man. Shaggy-coated muskox.
And there, not more than 20 meters to my left, I saw the magnificent creature Lin Yong had indicated. I was surprised to see that the shaggy-coated muskox was only somewhat shaggy. But he did have a fine set of horns, and a tail that looked much like a piece of rope with a fluffy tip.
Hop chow su wee, boss man.
I ordered Lin Yong confined to this tent for interrupting me so frequently. And then, with the aid of the remaining Sherpas, we fired our harmless tranquilizer gun at the shaggy-coated muskox. And once the injection had penetrated the animal's shaggy coat, we easily overpowered him and started out again across the trackless snow with our prized specimen well in hand. Our pack mules weren't waiting where we thought we had left them, and so our overland trek on foot became even more arduous.
Pack mules, boss man! Pack mules!
Ling Yong came rushing out of his tent to bring me the good news, even though I'd told him to stay there. But the words he spoke were true. The pack mules were there, indeed, and in good health. We fashioned a sling that enabled two of the mules to bear the bulky weight of the shaggy-coated muskox and headed back down the mountain. Slowly, our caravan made its way down the treacherous, narrow trails. Past the 20,000-foot level we went, then 19,000, then 18. At last, we reached the base camp, where motorized transportation awaited us. Sadly, the time had come for my faithful Sherpa guide, Lin Yong, to bid me a hasty farewell.
Bye-bye, boss man.
And now, little remained for me to do but to get the shaggy-coated muskox safely aboard ship for the long voyage home, where I knew that Dr. Wilfred Schlocky, the curator of the Altoona Zoo, was waiting to meet me, and the good doctor was standing on the deck when we reached the States, and he quickly rushed aboard to see my rare and handsome zoological specimen.
It's a handsome zoological specimen, all right, Byrne, but it's not a rare shaggy-coated muskox. It's an ordinary domestic yak. I wouldn't give you a dime for a carload of them.
And so it was that the long voyage ended. Another trip to the far corners of the earth in quest of a rare and exotic form of animal life.
This has been Byrne Voyle's Vanishing World of Vanishing Animals. Join us again soon when Byrne and his faithful crew will take us to the distant headwaters of the Blue Nile in search of the short-necked giraffe, another vanishing animal in this vanishing world of ours. And again, it's time for Bridget Hillary and the News, the exciting but often dramatic story of a girl radio reporter who dares to tell the truth in her hard-hitting weekly broadcast. As our scene opens today, Bridget is in the rehearsal room at the Amalgamated Broadcasting System as her elderly father, Badgett Hillary, enters.
Why, Daddy, what in the world are you doing here during the harvest season? I thought you'd be busy back on the farm putting the fodder in the shock or whatever.
No, I'm getting too old to do manual labor, Bridget. Then, as you know, my mule died last winter, so I'm just letting the crops rot in the fields.
2 minutes to airtime, Miss Hillary.
In a way, I suppose it's too bad you refused to lend me the money to buy another mule. But maybe it's just as well I move into town. None of my old friends speak to me anymore, now that you're broadcasting those stories about all us farmers being rich.
Well, I think you're wise to retire and live on the bundle you've made. You could move to Nassau, Palm Springs, or wherever the rich farmers go after they've bled the public white.
Bridget, you surely don't believe those stories you've been putting on the air. You know I've never saved any money farming those 40 acres of poor soil.
1 minute to airtime, Miss Hillary.
I'm sure you had good reason not to lend me money when I needed it desperately, but it couldn't be because you thought a small farmer like me could ever get rich.
Well, I'm sorry you're feeding me this sob story, Daddy. Apparently you don't realize that I have news sources inside the Agriculture Department. And tonight I'm going on the air with my latest report that you and others like you are milking the people for almost $10 billion a year.
I wish you wouldn't use my name again when you give out figures like that, Bridget. It's the agricultural income for the whole country. But you keep implying that I got most of it.
You're on the air, Miss Hillary.
Actually, I'm losing my shirt. But my old friends believe whatever they hear on the radio, and now none of them will speak to me anymore.
Well, they probably just don't have time. Running a farm has gotten to be such a big, mechanized, multi-million-dollar business. I must remember to mention on the air that the rich rural tycoons in your area are not on speaking terms, now that you've all hit the jackpot.
I'd really appreciate it if you wouldn't say that, Bridget. My old friends are almost as poor as I am. Of course, I'm a little worse off because my mule died. I couldn't get a loan to buy a new one.
Your program's off the air now, Miss Hillary. When you didn't show up in the studio, they just broadcast all four verses of the Star-Spangled Banner to fill the time.
Well, I don't want to overstay my welcome when you're probably in a hurry to get to the studio, but I was hoping I could make you realize that I'm not a food profiteer. It's those charges that caused my friends not to speak to me anymore.
Well, I've always tried to believe that blood is thicker than water, Daddy, but as a celebrity, I'm not just a member of our family anymore. I belong to all the people. And if I didn't lash out at you wealthy farmers, I'd be shirking my responsibility to the poor and the hungry of this great land of ours.
And so Bridget is forced to turn her back on the man who may have been the only father she ever had. But can she escape the pangs of regret? Be sure to join us next time when we'll hear the president of the Farmers Cooperative say,
"Expelling you is only part of it, Badgett. We're not even going to speak to you anymore."
That's in the next exciting episode of Bridget Hillary and the News.
And now, as a public service paid for by the National Radish Growers Institute, we present another educational session with the idol of the nation's youngsters, Mr. Science. As we look in on the modern, well-equipped laboratory today, we see that little Jimmy Schwab is just arriving to watch Mr. Science perform his latest fascinating experiment.
Oh, hello there, Jimmy. I was afraid you might not get here in time to watch me perform my latest fascinating experiment.
Ah, wild horses couldn't keep me away, Mr. Science. Not that I can think of any objection wild horses would have to my coming here. What's the fascinating experiment for today, sir?
Well, today, Jimmy, we're going to demonstrate how reducing friction enables many of our mechanical devices to operate more efficiently. Mm-hmm. Now, to prove that point, we're going to use this rusty hinge that I've attached to two blocks of wood here on the workbench. Now, notice how inefficiently it operates due to the friction. See?
Gosh, oh, hemlock, Mr. Science. That grating noise goes right up and down my little spine. Isn't there some way you can perform the experiment without making that awful squeak?
Yes, in fact, our main objective is to eliminate that squeak because that'll mean we've also reduced friction. But that point will become much more apparent to you after we perform today's experiment. Now, son, to demonstrate how reducing friction makes anything with moving parts operate more efficiently, we must first show how difficult it is to bend this hinge back and forth when it's dry and rusty.
Holy cow, Mr. Science. That sound just makes every nerve in my body twitch. It's as bad as scraping your fingernail across a blackboard.
All right. Well, now we'll get rid of that noise in just a moment, Jimmy. What you hear that annoys you so much is really just the sound of friction as two pieces of bare metal rub against each other. But that friction can be greatly reduced by inserting the fluid from this can between the layers of metal.
Gee, willikers, Mr. Science. That's a cute little can. Does the stuff inside of it have a name?
Yes, it does, Jimmy. It's called lubricating oil.
Lubricating oil. Golly, Wally Two Shoes. Wait till I tell my big brother I've seen some of that. He thinks he's so smart just because he got out of the sixth grade last year and I didn't.
Well, I'm sure you'll win greater respect from your brother after today, Jimmy. I'll just try to control your enthusiasm. Because we're getting to the best part of the experiment. And the thing we have to do next is help the lubricating oil soak in between the layers of metal by working the hinge back and forth a few times.
Oh, odds bodges, Mr. Science. If you don't stop that noise, it's going to drive me right straight up the wall.
Well, you can stop chewing on your suspenders to make it bearable, Jimmy, because if you'll notice, you can see that I'm still working the hinge back and forth, but now it's bending much more easily, and it isn't making any noise at all.
Great day in the morning, Mr. Science. The words you speak are true. What magic is this you performed to drive the evil spirits out of the hinge?
There's no magic to it at all, Jimmy. The lubricating oil has simply formed a coating over the two layers of metal and made them much smoother. As a result, the friction has been reduced. And, of course, the squeak that resulted from the friction is gone, too. So that proves how lubrication can make anything with moving parts operate more quietly and efficiently.
Wow, that sure is amazing, Mr. Science. I wonder what lubricating oil would do to the two metal plates in this tank if I coated both of them.
Oh, no. Don't do that, son. Those are electrodes I'm using in another experiment. They're both charged with high-voltage electricity.
Well, I don't care about that, Mr. Science. I just want to get them well lubricated so they won't start to squeak.
No. Stop it now, boy. The friction principle isn't even involved there.
This session with Mr. Science has been brought to you as a public service by the National Radish Growers Institute. Today's broadcast was the last in our current series. And we've received word now that Wally Blue is standing by in East Moline, Illinois, with a report on an unusual business enterprise. So come on in, please.
Wally Ballou.
Lee Ballou here in the main assembly room of the Apex Birdhouse Factory, East Moline, Illinois, with the president, Mr. Elwood Flick. Mr. Flick, I understand that you're one of the real pioneers among the birdhouse men here in the United States.
Well, I've been in the birdhouse game for quite a number of years, Mr. Ballou. In fact, I founded this firm when I was just a kid out of high school.
Uh-huh.
I had the idea that the public would really go for a well-built birdhouse that didn't need a lot of upkeep and repair work. So I started manufacturing wren houses out of hand-forged German steel.
Really built to last a lifetime.
Oh, huh? Yeah, they were rust-proof, and they had well-constructed roofs made out of little asphalt shingles. Each roof took 480 shingles, all nailed on by hand. And each house came complete with a stainless steel pole that you could mount it on.
Well, you must have had to ask quite a bit for a birdhouse like that.
Yeah, we had to get around $200 for them.
Did you sell many at that price?
I'd have to check our books to give you an accurate answer to that question, Mr. Ballou. But as I recall, we didn't sell any of them.
I see.
It looked as if the firm would go under, for sure, until I just happened to notice an article in one of our trade publications. According to this article, manufacturers were overproducing houses for certain types of birds. For example, the market is being flooded with about 400,000 new wren houses every year. And there just weren't that many new wrens coming along.
That meant that a lot of them stood vacant, I guess, huh?
A lot of them stood vacant. And in some areas, wrens would get confused and build nests in two or three different houses, you know, just trying to fill them all up. Of course, that caused problems, too.
Yeah, I imagine the wrens would forget which nest they'd laid their eggs in and all that sort of
thing.
That's
right. They'd forget which nest they laid their eggs in.
That
and
too.
As a result, only about 40% of the wren eggs laid in this country were getting hatched.
Sounds like a serious situation. What could you as a birdhouse manufacturer do about it?
Well, the first thing I did was to stop the production of wren houses immediately. Then I started checking around. I found out that nobody was manufacturing a house with a yellow-bellied sapsucker. I knew then that I'd found my life's work.
Started making yellow-bellied sapsucker houses. Did you continue using this hand-forged German steel?
Yeah, but through mass production, we got the price down to about $120, and the public began snapping them up. In less than 3 years, we were able to expand our plant and add scarlet tanager houses to our line.
And you still just make those two types of houses then, do you?
No, we put out houses now for both hoot owls and barn owls. We have a pelican house on the drawing boards that we hope to get into production by the first of next year.
Well,
and we have all kinds of plans.
I would think this new policy of yours would have done a great deal to promote bird life in America.
Yes, unlike most manufacturers in our field, we're strictly for the birds.
That's the story then from East Moline, Illinois. Wally Ballou returning it to Bob and Ray in New York.
If you've had it with winter in New York...
And back across the room to those very fine gentlemen, Bob and Ray.
Well, opening day is getting closer. Opening day in baseball, Stan. That's it for sports. Good night, and we'll see you tomorrow. And it does it for Bob and Ray today.
Hope to see you here at the WOR Radio Mystery Theater following Fulton Lewis News commentary. Tonight's show is called The Intruders, and it stars Lois Nettleton.
And we'll see you tomorrow at 4:15. Until then, this is Ray Goulding reminding you to write if you get work.
Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your thumb.
And this is WOR New York, an RKO general station.